From PRI, Public Radio International.
The old man who had been examining him straightened up as I came in. Porter was at the telephone trying to get the police. Tommy Howd's eyes were blue half dollars in a white face. Nothing in the corridors, I told the old man. He came up the elevator with Agnes Braden. She says he was alone. She saw nobody close to him. Quite so. The old man's voice and smile were pleasantly polite, as if the corpse at his feet had been part of a pattern in the carpet. 50 years of sleuthing had left him with no more emotion than a pawnbroker.
You're listening to John Shea reading from Dashiell Hammett's The Creeping Siamese, a gripping tale we'll hear on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Two adventure stories make up this program of Selected Shorts, one very urban and the other quite the opposite, a tale of adventure at sea, attempting to round Cape Horn in a sailing ship. We'll start with the city-bound story, Dashiell Hammett's detective fiction, The Creeping Siamese, which was taken from Black Mask magazine for an evening of crime stories at the Getty Center in Los Angeles. Dashiell Hammett was an American novelist who also worked as a Hollywood screenwriter. He's perhaps best known for his 1930 novel, The Maltese Falcon, which introduced the tough-talking private eye Sam Spade, brought to vivid life in the movie version by Humphrey Bogart. The Creeping Siamese is now read by another terrific actor, tough guy, John Shea.
Thank you, Isaiah. Standing beside the cashier's desk in the front office of the Continental Detective Agency's San Francisco branch, I was watching Porter check up my expense account when the man came in. He was a tall man, raw-boned, hard-faced. Gray clothes bagged loosely from his wide shoulders. In the late afternoon sunlight that came through the partially drawn blinds, his skin showed the color of new tan shoes. He opened the door briskly and then hesitated, standing in the doorway, holding the door open, turning the knob back and forth with one bony hand. There was no indecision on his face. It was ugly and grim, and its expression was the expression of a man who is remembering something disagreeable. Tommy Howd, our freckled and snub-nosed office boy, got up from his desk and went to the rail that divided the office. "Do you have an..." Tommy began and jumped back. The man had let go of the doorknob. He crossed his long arms over his chest, each hand gripping a shoulder. His mouth stretched wide in a yawn that had nothing to do with relaxation. His mouth clicked shut. His lips snarled back from clenched yellow teeth. "Hell!" he grunted, full of disgust, and pitched down on the floor. I heaved myself over the rail, stepped across his body, and went out into the corridor. Four doors away, Agnes Braden, a plump woman of 30-something who runs a public stenographic establishment, was going into her office. "Miss Braden!" I called, and she turned, waiting for me to come up. "Did you see the man who just came into our office?" "Yes." Curiosity put lights in her green eyes. "A tall man who came up the elevator with me? Why?" "Was he alone?" "Yes, that is, he and I were the only ones who got off at this floor." "Why?" "Did you see anybody close to him?" "No, though I didn't notice him in the elevator." "Why?" "Did he act funny?" "Not that I noticed." "Why?" "No, thanks, I'll drop in. I'll tell you about it later." I made a circuit of the corridors on our floor, finding nothing. The raw-boned man was still on the floor when I returned to the office, but he had been turned over on his back. He was as dead as I had thought. The old man who had been examining him straightened up as I came in. Porter was at the telephone trying to get the police. Tommy Howd's eyes were blue half-dollars in a white face. Nothing in the corridors, I told the old man. He came up the elevator with Agnes Braden. She says he was alone. She saw nobody close to him. Quite so. The old man's voice and smile were pleasantly polite, as if the corpse at his feet had been part of a pattern in the carpet. 50 years of sleuthing had left him with no more emotion than a pawnbroker. Yeah, seems to have been stabbed in the left breast, a rather large wound that was staunched with this piece of silk. One of his feet poked at a rumpled ball of red cloth on the floor, which seems to be a sarong. Today is never Tuesday to the old man. It seems to be Tuesday. On his person, he went on, I have found some $900 bills in various denominations and some silver, a gold watch and a pocket knife of English manufacture, a Japanese silver coin, 50 sen, tobacco, pipe and matches, a Southern Pacific timetable, two handkerchiefs without laundry marks, a pencil and several sheets of blank paper, 4 2-cent stamps, and a key labeled Hotel Montgomery, room 540. His clothes seem to be new. No doubt we shall learn something from them when we make a more thorough examination, which I do not care to make until the police come. Meanwhile, you had better go to the Montgomery and see what you can learn there. In the Hotel Montgomery's lobby, the first man I ran into was the one I wanted. Peterson, the house copper. A blonde, mustached ex-bartender who doesn't know any more about gumshoeing than I do about saxophones, but who does know people and how to handle them, which is what his job calls for. Hello, he greeted me. What's the score? 6-1 Seattle, end of the fourth. Hey, Pete, who's in 540? Hey, they're not playing in Seattle, you chump. Portland. A man who hasn't got the civic spirit to know where his team is playing. Hey, wait, Pete, stop. I haven't got time to be fooling with your childish pastimes. A man just dropped dead in our joint with one of your room keys in his pocket. 540. Civic spirit went bluey in Peterson's face. 540? Huh, he stared at the ceiling. That would be that fellow Rounds. Dropped dead, you say? Yeah, dead. Tumbled down in the middle of the floor with a knife cut in him. Now, who is this Rounds? Well, I couldn't tell you that much offhand. A big bony man with leathery skin. You know, I wouldn't have noticed him, except he was such a sour-looking body. Yeah, that's the bird. Let's look him up. At the desk, we learned that the man had arrived the day before, registering as H.R. Rounds, New York, and telling the clerk he expects to leave within 3 days. There was no record of mail or telephone calls for him. Nobody knew when he had gone out, since he had not left his key at the desk. Neither elevator boys nor bellhops could tell us anything. His room didn't add much to our knowledge. His baggage consisted of one pigskin bag, battered and scarred, and covered with the marks of labels that had been scraped off. It was locked. But traveling bags' locks don't amount to much. This one held us up for about 5 minutes. Rounds' clothes, some in the bag, some in the closet, were neither many nor expensive, but they were all new. The washable stuff was without laundry marks. Everything was of popular makes, widely advertised brands that could be bought in any city in the country. There wasn't a piece of paper with anything written on it. There wasn't an identifying tag. There wasn't anything in the room to tell where Rounds had come from or why. Peterson was peevish about it. Well, I guess if he hadn't gotten killed, he'd beat us out of a week's bill. You know, these guys that don't carry anything to identify them and don't leave their keys at the desk when they go out, they ain't to be trusted much. We had just finished our search when a bellhop brought Detective Sergeant O'Gar of the Police Department Homicide Detail into the room. Been down to the agency, I asked him. Oh, yeah, I just came from there. What's new? O'Gar pushed back his wide-brimmed black village constable hat and scratched his bullet head. Ah, not a heap. Doc says he was opened up with a blade at least 6 inches long by a couple wide, and that he couldn't have lived 2 hours after he got that blade. More likely not more than one. We didn't find any news on him. What do you got here? Well, his name is Rounds. He registered here yesterday from New York. His stuff is new, and there's nothing on any of it to tell us anything except that he didn't want to leave a trail. No letters, no memoranda, nothing. No blood, no signs of row. In the room. O'Gar turned to Peterson. Any brown men been around the hotel? Hindus or the like? Well, not that I saw, the house copper said, but I'll find out for you. Well, then the red silk was a sarong, I asked. And an expensive one, the detective sergeant said. I saw a lot of them the 4 years I was soldiering on the islands, but I never saw as good a one as that. Well, who wears them? Well, men and women in the Philippines, Borneo, Java, Sumatra, Malay Peninsula, parts of India. Well, so it's your idea that whoever did the carving advertised himself running around in the streets in a red petticoat? Hey, don't be funny, he growled at me. They're often enough twisted or folded up into sashes or girdles. How do I know he was knifed in the street, huh? For that matter, how do I know he wasn't cut down in your joint? Now, we always bury our victims without saying anything about them. Now, let's go down and give Pete a hand in the search for your brown men. That angle was empty. Any brown man who had snooped around the hotel had been too good to be caught at it. I telephoned the old man, telling him what I had learned, which didn't cost me much breath, and Ogar and I had spent the rest of the evening sharpshooting around without ever getting on target once. We questioned taxicab drivers, questioned the three rounds listed in the telephone book, and our ignorance was as complete when we were through as when we started. The morning papers on the streets a little after 8 o'clock that evening had the story as we knew it. At 11 o'clock, Ogar and I called it a night, separating in the direction of our respective beds. We didn't stay apart long. I opened my eyes, sitting on the side of my bed in the dim light of a moon that was just coming up with the ringing telephone in my hand. Ogar's voice. 1856 Broadway, on the hump. 1856 Broadway, I repeated, and he hung up. I finished waking up while I phoned for a taxicab and then wrestled my clothes on. My watch told me it was 12:55 a.m. as I went downstairs. I hadn't been 15 minutes in bed. 1856 Broadway was a three-story house set behind a pocket-sized lawn and a row of like houses behind like lawns. The others were dark. 1856 shed light from every window and from the front door, which was open. A policeman stood in the vestibule. Hello there, Mac. Ogar there? Hey, just went in. I walked into a brown and buff reception hall and saw the detective sergeant going up the wide stairs. What's up? I asked as I joined him. Don't know. On the second floor, we turned to the left, going into a library or a sitting room that stretched across the front of the house. A man in pajamas and bathrobe sat on a davenport there, with one bared leg stretching out on a chair in front of him. I recognized him when he nodded to me. Austin Richer, the owner of the Market Street Moving Picture Theater. He was a round-faced man of 45 or so, partly bald, for whom the agency had done some work a year or so before in connection with a ticket seller who had departed without returning in the day's receipts. In front of Richer, a thin white-haired man with doctor written all over him stood looking at Richer's leg, which was wrapped in a bandage just below the knee. Beside the doctor, a tall woman in a fur-trimmed dressing gown stood, a roll of gauze and a pair of scissors in her hands. A husky police corporal was writing in a notebook at a long, narrow table. A thick hickory walking stick on the bright blue table cover at his elbow. All of them looked around at us as we came into the room. The corporal got up and came over to us. Yeah, I knew you were handling the rounds job, Sergeant, so I thought I'd best get word to you as soon as I heard there was brown men mixed up in all this. Good work, Flynn, Ogar said. What happened here? Burglary, or maybe only attempted burglary, as there was four of them. They crashed in through the kitchen door. Richard was sitting up very straight, and his blue eyes were suddenly excited, as were the brown eyes of the woman. I beg your pardon, he said, but is there... You mentioned brown men in connection with another affair. Is there another? Ogar looked at me. Well, you haven't seen the morning papers, I asked the theater owner. No. Well, a man came into the Continental office late this afternoon with a stab in his chest, and he died there. Pressed against the wound as if to stop the bleeding was a sarong, which is where we got the brown men idea. His name? Rounds, H.R. Rounds. The name brought no recognition to Richard's eyes. A tall man, thin, with dark skin, he asked, in a gray suit? Yeah, all of that? Richard twisted around to look at the woman. Malloy! He exclaimed. Malloy! She exclaimed. Well, So you know him? Their faces came back toward me. Well, yes, he was here this afternoon. He left. Richard stopped, and he turned to the woman again, questioning me. Well, yes, Austin, she said, putting the gauze and scissors on the table and sitting down beside him on the davenport. Tell them. He patted her hand, and he looked up at me again with the expression of a man who has seen a nice spot in which to lay down a heavy load. Well, sit down. It isn't a long story, but no, do sit down. Well, we found ourselves chairs. Malloy, Sam Malloy, that is his name, or the name I've always known him by. He came here this afternoon. He'd either called up the theater or gone there, and they had told him that I was home. I hadn't seen him for 3 years. And we could see, both my wife and I, that there was something the matter with him when he came in. And when I asked him, he said that he'd been stabbed by a Siamese on his way here. He didn't seem to think that the wound amounted to much, or pretended he didn't. He wouldn't let us fix it for him or even look at it. He said he'd go to the doctor after he left, after he'd got rid of the thing. That was what he'd come to me for. He wanted me to hide it or to take care of it until he came for it again. And he didn't talk much. Well, he was in a hurry and suffering. And I didn't ask him any questions. I couldn't refuse him anything. I couldn't question him, even though he as good as told us that it was illegal as well as dangerous. He'd saved our lives once, more than my wife's life, down in Mexico, where we first knew him. That was in 1916. We were caught down there during the Villa troubles, and Malloy was running guns over the border, and he had enough influence with the bandits to have us released when it looked as if we were done for. So this time, when he wanted me to do something for him, I couldn't ask him about it. I said yes, and he gave me the package. It wasn't a large package, about the size of, well, a loaf of bread, perhaps, but quite heavy for its size. It was wrapped in brown paper. We unwrapped it after he had gone, that is. I mean, we took the paper off, but the inner wrapping was of canvas and was tied with silk cord and sealed, so no, we didn't open that. We put it upstairs in the pack room under a pile of old magazines. And then, at about 11:45 tonight, I'd only been in bed a few minutes, I hadn't gone to sleep yet, I heard a noise in here. Now, I don't own a gun, and there's nothing that you could properly call a weapon in the house, but that walking stick, and he indicated the hickory stick on the table, was in the closet in our bedroom, so I got that, and I came in here to see what the noise was. And right outside the bedroom door, I ran into a man. I could see him better than he could see me because this door was open and he showed against the window. He was between me and it, and the moonlight showed him fairly clear. And I hit him with the stick, but didn't knock him down. He turned and he ran in here, and foolishly, not thinking that he might not be alone, I ran after him. And another man shot me in the leg just as I came through the door. And I fell, of course. And while I was getting up, two of them came in with my wife between them. There were four of them. They were medium-sized men, brown skin, but not so dark. And I took it for granted that they were Siamese, because Malloy had spoken of Siamese. And they turned on the lights here, and one of them, who seemed to be the leader, asked me, "Where is it?" You know, his accent was pretty bad, but you could understand his words good enough. And, of course, I knew that they were after what Malloy had left, but I pretended I didn't. They told me, or rather the leader did, that he knew that it had been left here, but he called Malloy by another name, Dawson, and I said, I don't know any Dawson, and nothing had been left here, and I tried to tell them to tell me what they expected to find, but they wouldn't do. They just called it it. And they talked among themselves, but of course I couldn't make out a word of what they were saying, and then three of them went out, leaving one here to guard us, and he had a Luger pistol. And we could hear the others moving around in the house. The search must have lasted an hour. And then the one that I took for the leader came in, and he said something to our guard, and both of them looked quite elated. "It is not wise if you will leave this room for many minutes," the leader said to me. And then they left, both of them, and they closed the door behind them. And I knew they were going, but I couldn't walk on this leg, and from what the doctor says, I'll be lucky if I walk on it inside a couple of months. I didn't want my wife to go out and perhaps run into one of them before they'd got away, but she insisted on going, and she'd found they'd gone, and she telephoned the police and then ran up to the pack room and found Malloy's package was gone. "And this Malloy, it didn't give you any hint at all of what was in the package?" O'Gar asked when Richard was finished. "No, not a word, except that it was something the Siamese were after." Did he know the Siamese had stabbed him?" I asked. "I think so," Richard said slowly, "though I'm not sure that he said he did." "Well, do you remember his words?" Not exactly, I'm afraid." "I think I remember them," Mrs. Richard said. "My husband, Mr. Richard, asked him, 'What's the matter, Malloy? Are you hurt or sick?' Malloy gave a little laugh, putting a hand on his chest and said, "Nothing much. I run into some Siamese who was looking for me on my way here and got careless and let him scratch me. But I kept my little bundle," and then he laughed again and he patted the package. "Did he say anything else about the Siamese?" Not directly," she replied, "though he did tell us to watch out for any Asiatics that we saw around the neighborhood. He said that he wouldn't leave the package if he thought it would make trouble for us, but there was always a chance that something could go wrong and we'd better be careful. And he told my husband," nodding at Richard, "that the Siamese had been dogging him for months, but now that he had a safe place for the package, he was going to take them for a walk and forget to bring them back." Yes, that was the way he put it. "So how much do you know about Malloy?" "Well, not a great deal, I'm afraid," Richard took up the answering again. "He liked to talk about the places he'd been, of course, and the things that he'd seen, but you couldn't get a word out of him about his own affairs. We met him first in Mexico, as I told you, in 1916, after he saved us down there and got us away. We didn't see him again for nearly 4 years. He rang the bell one night. He came in for an hour or two. He was on his way to China. He said he had a lot of business to attend to before he left the next day. And some months later, I had a letter from him from the Queen's Hotel in Kandy asking me to send him a list of the importers and exporters in San Francisco. He wrote me a letter thanking me for the list, and I didn't hear again from him until he came to San Francisco for a week about a year later. That was in 1921, I think. And he was here for another week about a year after that, telling us that he'd been in Brazil, but as usual, saying nothing about what he'd been doing there. And some months later, I had a letter from him from Chicago saying that he would be here the following week. However, he didn't come. Instead, sometime later, he wrote from Vladivostok saying that he hadn't been able to make it. And today was the first day we'd heard of him since then. And where's his home? I mean, you know, his people. Well, he was always saying he has neither. But I have an idea that he was born in England, though I don't know that he ever said so or what made me think so. You got any more questions? I asked O'Gar. No, let's give the place an eye and see if the Siamese left any leads behind. The eye we gave the house was thorough. We didn't split the territory between us, but went over everything together. Everything from roof to cellar, every nook, every drawer, every corner. The cellar did the most for us. It was there, in the cold furnace, that we found the handful of black buttons and the fire-darkened garter clasps. But the upper floors hadn't been altogether worthless. In one room, we had found the crumpled sail slip of an Oakland store marked one table cover. And in another room, we had found no garters. "Of course, it's none of my business," I told Richard when O'Gar and I joined the others again. "But I think maybe if you plead self-defense, you might get away with it." He tried to jump up from the davenport, but his shot leg failed him. The woman got up slowly. "And maybe that would leave an out for you," O'Gar told her. "Why don't you try to persuade him? Wait, or maybe it would be better if you pled the self-defense," I suggested to her. "You could say that Richard ran to your help when your husband grabbed you, and that your husband shot him and was turning his gun on you when you stabbed him. That would sound smooth enough." "My husband?" "Uh-huh. Mrs. Rounds Malloy Dawson. Your late husband, anyway." Richard got his mouth far enough closed to get words out of it. "Well, what is the meaning of this damn nonsense?" he demanded. "Them's harsh words to come from a fellow like you," O'Gar growled at him. "If this is nonsense, what do you make of that yarn you told us about creeping Siamese and mysterious bundles and God knows what all?" "Don't be too hard on him," I told O'Gar. "Being around movies all the time has poisoned his idea of what sounds plausible. If it hadn't, he'd have known better than to see a Siamese in the moonlight at 11:45 when the moon was just coming up at somewhere around 12:45 when you phoned me." Richard stood up on his one good leg. The husky police corporal stepped closer to him. "Hadn't I better frisk him, Sergeant?" O'Gar shook his bullet head. "Nah, waste of time. He's got nothing on him. They cleaned the place of weapons. The chances are the lady dropped them in the bay when she rode over to Oakland to get a table cover to take the place of the sarong her husband carried away with him." That shook the pair of them. Richard pretended he hadn't gulped, and the woman had a fight of it before she could make her eyes stay still on mine. Ogar struck while the iron was still hot by bringing the buttons and the garter clasps we had salvaged out of his pocket and letting them trickle from one hand to the other. That used up the last bit of facts we had. I threw a lie at them. Never me to knock the press, but you don't want to put too much confidence in what the papers say. For instance, a fellow might say a few pregnant words before he died, and the papers might say he didn't. A thing like that might confuse things. The woman reared up her head and looked at Ogar. May I speak to Austin alone? She asked. Now, I don't mean out of your sight. The detective sergeant scratched his head and looked at me. This letting your victims go into conference is always a ticklish business. They may decide to come clean, and then again, they may frame up a new out. On the other hand, if you don't let them, the chances are they get stubborn on you, and you can't get anything out of them. One way was as risky as another. I grinned at Ogar and refused to make a suggestion. He could decide for himself, and if he was wrong, I'd have him to dump the blame on. He scowled at me and then nodded to the woman. You can go over into that corner and whisper together for a couple of minutes, he said, but no foolishness. She gave Richard the hickory stick, took his other arm and helped him hobble to a far corner, pulled a chair over there for him. He sat with his back to us. She stood behind him, leaning over his shoulder so that both their faces were hidden from us. Ogar came closer to me. What do you think, he muttered. I think they'll come through. That shot of yours about being Malloy's wife hit center, I missed that one. How'd you make it? Well, she was telling me what Malloy had said about the Siamese. She took pains both times she said my husband to show that she meant richer. So, well, the whispering in the far corner had been getting louder, so that the S's had become sharp hisses. Now a clear, emphatic sentence came from Richard's mouth. I'll be damned if I will. Both of them looked furtively over their shoulders and they lowered their voices again, but not for long. The woman was apparently trying to persuade him to do something. He kept shaking his head. He put a hand on her arm. She pushed it away and kept on whispering. He said aloud, deliberately, well, go ahead if you want to be a fool. It's your neck. I didn't put the knife in him. She jumped away from him, her eyes black blazes in a white face. Ogar and I moved softly toward them. You rat! She spat at Richard and spun to face us. I killed him, she cried. This thing in the chair tried to, but I... Richard swung the hickory stick. I jumped for it, missed, crashed into the back of his chair. Hickory stick, Richard, chair, and I sprawled together on the floor. The corporal helped me up. He and I picked Richard up and put him on the davenport again. The woman's story poured out of her angry mouth. His name wasn't Malloy. It was Lang, Sam Lang. I married him in Providence in 1913 and went to China with him, to Canton, where he had a position on a steamship line. We didn't stay there long because he got into some trouble through being mixed up in the revolution that year. And after that, we drifted around, mostly in Asia. And then we met this thing. She pointed at the now sullenly quiet Richard in Singapore in 1919, I think, right after the World War was over. His name is Holly. Holly. And Scotland Yard can tell you something about him. He had a proposition. He knew of a gem bed in Upper Burma, one of the many that were hidden from the British when they took the country. He knew the natives who were working it. He knew where they were hiding their gems. My husband and I went in with him, with two other men that were killed. They looted the natives' cash and got away with a whole sackful of sapphires, topazes, even a few rubies. The two other men were killed by the natives, and my husband was badly wounded. We didn't think he would live. We were hiding in a hut near the Yunnan border. Holly persuaded me to take the gems and run away with them. It looked as if Sam was done for, and if we stayed there long, we'd be caught. I can't say that I was crazy about Sam anyway. He wasn't the kind you would be after living with him for a while. And so Holly and I took it, and we lit out. And we used a lot of the stones to buy our way through Yunnan and Guangxi and Guangdong, but we made it, and we got to San Francisco with enough to buy this house and the movie theater, and we've been here since. We've been honest since we came here, but I don't suppose that means anything. We had enough money to keep us comfortable. And then today, Sam showed up. We hadn't heard of him since we'd left him on his back in Burma.
He said he'd been caught in jail for 3 years, then he'd gotten away and had spent the other three hunting for us. Well, he was that kind. He didn't want me back, but he did want money. He wanted everything we had. Holly lost his nerve. Instead of bargaining with Sam, he lost his head. He tried to shoot him. Sam took his gun away from him and shot him in the leg. And in the scuffle, Sam had dropped a knife, a kris, I think, and I picked it up, but he grabbed me just as I got it, and I don't know how it happened. All I saw was Sam staggering back, holding his chest with both hands, and the kris shining red in my hand. Sam had dropped his gun, and Holly got it and was all for shooting Sam, but I wouldn't let him. It happened here, in this room. And I don't remember whether I gave Sam the sarong that we used for a cover on the table or not. Anyway, he tried to stop the blood with it. And he went away then, while I kept Holly from shooting him. I knew Sam wouldn't go to the police, but I didn't know what to do. I knew he was hurt bad. If he'd dropped dead somewhere, the chances are he'd be traced here. I watched from a window as he went down the street, and nobody seemed to pay any attention to him, but he looked so conspicuously wounded to me that I thought everybody would be sure to remember him if he got into the papers that he'd been found dead somewhere. And Holly was even more scared than I. We couldn't run away because he had a shot leg, so we made up that Siamese story, and I went over to Oakland, and I bought the table cover to take the place of the sarong. And we had some guns and even a few oriental knives and swords here, and I wrapped them up in paper, breaking the swords, and I dropped them off the ferry when I went to Oakland. And when the morning papers came out, we read what had happened, and then we went ahead with what we had planned. We burned the suit Holly had worn when he was shot and his garters, because the pants had a bullet hole in them, and the bullet had cut one of the garters. And we fixed a hole in his pajama leg, unbandaged his leg. I fixed it as well as I could, and washed away the clotted blood until it began to bleed again. And then I gave the alarm. And she raised both hands in a gesture of finality and made a clucking sound with her tongue. "And there you are," she said. "And you got anything to say?" I asked Holly, who was staring at his bandaged leg. "To my lawyer," he said without looking up. O'Gar spoke to the corporal. "Flynn, the wagon." 10 minutes later, we were in the street helping Holly and the woman into a police car. Around the corner on the other side of the street came 3 brown-skinned men, apparently Malay sailors. The one in the middle seemed to be drunk, and the 2 others were supporting him. And one of them had a package that could have held a bottle under his arm. O'Gar looked from them to me and laughed. "Well, we wouldn't be doing a thing to those 2 babies right now if we'd fallen for that yarn, would we?" he whispered. "Ah, shut up, you big heap," I growled back, nodding at Holly, who was in the car now. "If that bird sees them, he'll identify them as his Siamese, and God knows what a jury would make of it." So we made the puzzled driver twist the car 6 blocks out of his way to be sure we'd miss the brown men. And it was worth it, because nothing interfered with the 20 years of peace that Holly and Mrs. Lang drew.
Dashiell Hammett's The Creeping Siamese, read for us by John Shea. This radio program is now available as a free MP3 podcast, so you can subscribe and listen to the download on your computer or MP3 player anytime, anywhere. Subscribe today on iTunes or at PRI.org. We'll be back in a flash with A Thrilling Tale of the Sea by Jack London. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our second adventure story takes us into another world entirely, the world of the clipper ships sailing around the southern tip of South America before there was a dream of a shortcut through the Panama Canal. It is Jack London's story called Make Westing. Jack London lived from 1876 to 1916 and is remembered for stories about men and animals battling hostile environments like Cape Horn or the Arctic, the classic To Build a Fire, and novels such as The Call of the Wild, White Fang, and The Sea Wolf. The reader at the Getty Center in Los Angeles is the late Stephen Gilborn, who may be best remembered as Ellen DeGeneres' sweet father on the TV series Ellen. Now he reads Jack London's Make Westing.
For 7 weeks, the Mary Rogers had been between 50 degrees south in the Atlantic and 50 degrees south in the Pacific, which meant that for 7 weeks she had been struggling to round Cape Horn. For 7 weeks she had been either in dirt or close to dirt, save once, and then following upon 6 days of excessive dirt which she had ridden out under the shelter of the redoubtable Terra del Fuego coast, she had almost gone ashore during a heavy swell in the dead calm that had suddenly fallen. For 7 weeks, she had wrestled with the Cape Horn graybeards and in return been buffeted and smashed by them. She was a wooden ship, and her ceaseless straining had opened her seams so that twice a day the watch took its turn at the pumps. The Mary Rogers was strained. The crew was strained. And Big Dan Cullen, master, was likewise strained. Perhaps he was strained most of all, for upon him rested the responsibility of that titanic struggle. He slept most of the time in his clothes, though he rarely slept. He haunted the deck at night, a great, burly, robust ghost, black with the sunburn of 30 years at sea and hairy as an orangutan. He, in turn, was haunted by one thought of action, a sailing direction for the Horn. Whatever you do, make westing. Make westing. It was an obsession. He thought of nothing else except at times to blaspheme God for sending such bitter weather. Make westing. He hugged the Horn and a dozen times lay hove to with the Iron Cape bearing east by north or north-northeast a score of miles away. And each time the eternal west wind smote him back and he made easting. He fought gale after gale south to 64 degrees inside the Antarctic drift ice and pledged his immortal soul to the powers of darkness for a bit of westing, for a slant to take him around. And he made easting. In despair, he had tried to make the passage through the Straits of Lemaire. Halfway through, the wind hauled to the northward of northwest, the glass dropped to 28.88, and he turned and ran before a gale of cyclonic fury, missing by a hair's breadth, piling up the Mary Rogers on the black-toothed rocks. Twice he had made west to the Diego Ramirez rocks, one of the times saved between two snow squalls by sighting the gravestones of ships a quarter of a mile dead ahead. Below, Captain Dan Cullen instanced all his 30 years at sea to prove that never had it blown so before. The Mary Rogers was hove to at the time he gave the evidence, and to clinch it, inside half an hour, the Mary Rogers was hove down to the hatches. Her new main topsail and brand new spencer were blown away like tissue paper, and 5 sails, furled and fast under double gaskets, were blown loose and slipped from the yards. And before morning, the Mary Rogers was hove down twice again, and holes were knocked in her bulwarks to ease her decks from the weight of ocean that pressed her down. On an average of once a week, Captain Dan Cullen caught glimpses of the sun. Once for 10 minutes, the sun shone at midday, and 10 minutes afterward, a new gale was piping up, both watches were shortening sail, and all was buried in the obscurity of a driving snow squall. For a fortnight once, Captain Dan Cullen was without a meridian or a chronometer sight. Rarely did he know his position within half a degree, except when in sight of land. for sun and stars remained hidden behind the sky, and it was so gloomy that even at the best the horizons were poor for accurate observation. A gray gloom shrouded the world. The clouds were gray. The great driving seas were leaden gray. The smoking crests were a gray churning. Even the occasional albatrosses were gray, while the snow flurries were not white, but gray under the somber pall of the heavens. Life on board the Mary Rogers was gray, gray and gloomy. The faces of the sailors were blue-gray. They were afflicted with sea cuts and sea boils and suffered exquisitely. They were shadows of men. For 7 weeks, in the forecastle or on deck, they had not known what it was to be dry. They had forgotten what it was to sleep out a watch, and all watches, it was all hands on deck. They caught the snatches of agonized sleep, and they slept in their oilskins ready for the everlasting call. So weak and worn were they that it took both watches to do the work of one. That was why both watches were on deck so much of the time, and no shadow of a man could shirk duty. Nothing less than a broken leg could enable a man to knock off work, and there were two such who had been mauled and pulped by the seas that broke aboard. One other man who was the shadow of a man was George Dougherty. He was the only passenger on board, friend of the firm, and he had elected to make the voyage for his health. But 7 weeks off Cape Horn had not bettered his health. He gasped and panted in his bunk through the long, heaving nights, and when on deck, he was so bundled up for warmth that he resembled a peripatetic old clothes shop. At midday, eating at the cabin table, in a gloom so deep that the swinging sea lamps burned always, he looked as blue-gray as the sickest, saddest man forward. Nor did gazing across the table at Captain Dan Cullen have any cheering effect upon him. Captain Cullen chewed and scowled and kept silent. The scowls were for God, and with every chew he reiterated the sole thought of his existence, which was, make westing. He was a big, hairy brute, and the sight of him was not stimulating to the other's appetite. He looked upon George Dougherty as a Jonah and told him so once each meal, savagely transferring the scowl from God to the passenger and back again. Nor did the mate prove a first aid to a languid appetite. Joshua Higgins by name, a seaman by profession and pull, but a potwalloper by capacity. He was a loose-jointed, sniffling creature, heartless and selfish and cowardly, without a soul, in fear of his life of Dan Cullen, and a bully over the sailors, who knew that behind the mate was Captain Cullen, the lawgiver and compeller, the driver and the destroyer, the incarnation of a dozen bucko mates. In that wild weather at the southern end of the earth, Joshua Higgins ceased washing. His grimy face usually robbed George Dougherty of what little appetite he managed to accumulate. Ordinarily, this lavatorial dereliction would have caught Captain Cullen's eye in vocabulary, but at the present his mind was filled with making westing, to the exclusion of all other things not contributory thereto. Whether the mate's face was clean or dirty had no bearing upon westing. Later on, when 50 degrees south in the Pacific had been reached, Joshua Higgins would wash his face very abruptly. In the meantime, at the cabin table, where gray twilight alternated with lamplight while the lamps were being filled, George Dougherty sat between the two men, one a tiger and the other a hyena, and wondered why God made them. The second mate, Matthew Turner, was a true sailor and a man, but George Dougherty did not have the solace of his company for aid by himself. Solitary when they had finished. On Saturday morning, July 24th, George Dougherty awoke to a feeling of life and headlong movement. On deck, he found the Mary Rogers running off before a howling southeaster. Nothing was set but the lower topsails and the foresail. It was all she could stand, yet she was making 14 knots, as Mr. Turner shouted in Dougherty's ear when he came on deck. And it was all westing. She was going around the horn at last, if the wind held. Mr. Turner looked happy. The end of the struggle was in sight. But Captain Cullen did not look happy. He scowled at Dougherty in passing. Captain Cullen did not want God to know that he was pleased with that wind. He had a conception of a malicious God and believed in his secret soul that if God knew it was a desirable wind, God would promptly efface it and send a snorter from the west. So he walked softly before God, smothering his joy down under scowls and muttered curses, and so fooling God. For God was the only thing in the universe of which Dan Cullen was afraid. All Saturday and Saturday night, the Mary Rogers raced her westing. Persistently, she logged her 14 knots so that by Sunday morning, she had covered 350 miles. If the wind held, she would make a round. If it failed and the snorter came from anywhere between southwest and north, back the Mary Rogers would be hurled and be no better off than she had been 7 weeks before. And on Sunday morning, the wind was failing. The big sea was going down and running smooth. Both watches were on deck, setting sail after sail as fast as the ship could stand it. And now Captain Cullen went around brazenly before God, smoking a big cigar, smiling jubilantly, as if the failing wind delighted him. While down underneath he was raging against God for taking the life out of the blessed wind. Make westing! So he would, if God would only leave him alone. Secretly, he pledged himself anew to the powers of darkness if they would let him make westing. He pledged himself so easily because he did not believe in the powers of darkness. He really believed only in God, though he did not know it. And in his inverted theology, God was really the Prince of Darkness. Captain Cullen was a devil worshiper. But he called the devil by another name, that was all. At midday, after calling 8 bells, Captain Cullen ordered the royals on. The men went aloft faster than they had gone in weeks. Not alone were they nimble because of the westing, but a benignant sun was shining down and limbering their stiff bodies. George Doherty stood aft near Captain Cullen, less bundled in clothes than usual, soaking in the grateful warmth as he watched the scene. Swiftly and abruptly, the incident occurred. There was a cry from the fore royal yard of, "Man overboard!" Somebody threw a lifebuoy over the side, and at the same instant the second mate's voice came aft, ringing and peremptory, "Hard down your helm!" The man at the wheel never moved a spoke. He knew better, for Captain Dan Cullen was standing alongside of him. He wanted to move a spoke, to move all the spokes, to grind the wheel down, hard down for his comrade drowning in the sea. He glanced at Captain Dan Cullen, and Captain Dan Cullen gave no sign. "Down! Hard down!" second mate roared as he sprang aft. But he ceased springing and commanding and stood still when he saw Dan Cullen by the wheel. And big Dan Cullen puffed at his cigar and said nothing. Astern and going astern fast could be seen the sailor. He had caught the lifebuoy and was clinging to it. Nobody spoke. Nobody moved. The men aloft clung in the royal yards and watched with terror-stricken faces. And the Mary Rogers raced on, making her westing. A long, silent minute passed. "Who was it?" Captain Cullen demanded. "Mops, sir," eagerly answered the sailor at the wheel. Mops topped a wave astern and disappeared temporarily in the trough. It was a large wave, but it was no Greybeard. Small boat could live easily in such a sea, and in such a sea the Mary Rogers could easily come too. But she could not come too and make westing at the same time. For the first time in all his years, George Doherty was seeing a real drama of life and death, a sordid little drama in which the scales balanced an unknown sailor named Mops against a few miles of longitude. At first he had watched the man astern, but now he watched big Dan Cullen, hairy and black, vested with power of life and death, smoking a cigar. Captain Dan Cullen smoked another long, silent minute. Then he removed the cigar from his mouth. He glanced aloft at the spars of the Mary Rogers and overside at the sea. "Sheet on the royals," he cried. 15 minutes later, they sat at table in the cabin with food served before them. On one side of George Dougherty sat Dan Cullen, the tiger. On the other side, Joshua Higgins, the hyena. Nobody spoke. On deck, the men were sheeting home the skysails. George Dougherty could hear their cries while a persistent vision haunted him of a man called Mops, alive and well, clinging to a life buoy miles astern in that lonely ocean. He glanced at Captain Cullen and experienced a feeling of nausea, for the man was eating his food with relish. He was almost bolting it. "Captain Cullen," Dougherty said, "you are in command of this ship, and it is not proper for me to comment now upon what you do. But I wish to say one thing. There is a hereafter, and yours will be a hot one." Captain Cullen did not even scowl. In his voice was a regret as he said, "It was blowing a living gale. It was impossible to save the man." "He fell from the royal yard," Dougherty called, cried hotly. "You were setting the royals at the time. 15 minutes afterwards, you were setting the skysails." "It was a living gale, wasn't it, Mr. Higgins?" Captain Cullen said, turning to the mate. "Oh, if you brought her to, it'd have taken the sticks out of her," was the mate's answer. "You did the proper thing, Captain Cullen. The man hadn't a ghost of a show." George Dougherty made no answer, and to the meal's end, no one spoke. After that, Dougherty had his meals served in his stateroom. Captain Cullen scowled at him no longer, though no speech was exchanged between them, while the Mary Rogers sped north toward warmer latitudes. At the end of the week, Dan Cullen cornered Dougherty on deck. "What are you going to do when we get to Frisco?" he demanded bluntly. "I am going to swear out a warrant for your arrest," Dougherty answered quietly. "I am going to charge you with murder, and I am going to see you hanged for it." "You're almighty sure of yourself," Captain Cullen sneered, turning on his heel. A second week passed, and one morning found George Dougherty standing in the coach house companionway at the forward end of the long poop, taking his first gaze around the deck. The Mary Rogers was reaching full and by in a stiff breeze. Every sail was set and drawn, including the staysails. Captain Cullen strolled forward along the poop. He strolled carelessly, glancing at the passenger out of the corner of his eye. Dougherty was looking the other way, standing with head and shoulders outside the companionway, and only the back of his head was to be seen. Captain Cullen, with swift eye, embraced the main staysail block and the head and estimated the distance. He glanced about him. Nobody was looking. Aft, Joshua Higgins, pacing up and down, had just turned his back and was going the other way. Captain Cullen bent over suddenly and cast the staysail sheet off from its pin. The heavy block hurtled through the air, smashing Dougherty's head like an eggshell, and hurtling on and back and forth as the staysail whipped and slatted in the wind. Joshua Higgins turned around to see what he'd carried away and met the full blast of the vilest portion of Captain Cullen's profanity. "I made the sheet fast myself," whimpered the mate in the first lull, "with an extra turn to make sure. I remember it distinctly." "Made fast," the captain snarled back for the benefit of the watch as it struggled to capture the flying sail before it tore to ribbons. "You couldn't make your grandmother fast, you useless hell scullion. If you made that sheet fast with an extra turn, why in hell didn't it stay fast? That's what I want to know. Why in hell didn't it stay fast?" The mate whined inarticulately. "Oh, shut up," was the final word of Captain Cullen. Half an hour later, he was as surprised as any when the body of George Dougherty was found inside the companionway on the floor. In the afternoon, alone in his room, he doctored up his log. "Ordinary seaman Carl Brune," he wrote, "lost overboard from fore royal yard in a gale of wind. Was running at the time, and for the safety of the ship did not dare to come up the wind. Nor could a boat have lived in the sea that was running." On another page he wrote, had often warned Mr. Doherty about the danger he ran because of his carelessness on deck. I told him once that someday he would get his head knocked off by a block. A carelessly fastened main staysail sheet was the cause of the accident, which was deeply to be regretted because Mr. Doherty was a favorite with all of us. Captain Dan Cullen read over his literary effort with admiration, blotted the page, and closed the log. He lighted a cigar and stared before him. He felt the Mary Rogers lift and heel and surge along and knew that she was making 9 knots. A smile of satisfaction slowly dawned on his black and hairy face. Well, anyway, he had made his westing and fooled God.
Make Westing by Jack London was read for us by Stephen Gilborn. This is Selected Shorts, and we're interested in your response to these programs. Please email us at shorts@symphonyspace.org or write to Selected Shorts, care of Symphony Space, 2537 Broadway, New York, New York, 10025. Please include a stamped self-addressed envelope when you write. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.